Okay, so let's start. Welcome to the condensed matter review course that will entertain you in the next 3 weeks. So, in the next 3 weeks, we will explore three different topics that are important in modern condensed matter theory. So the first one that will occupy the first week, maybe plus one day, because I understand that Thursday there are no Psi classes. So I'll see how we go with the schedule for that. So the first week, we will talk about quantum phase transitions. The reference book for this part is the book with the same title by Subir Sachdev. I believe there is a number of copies in the library. Plus, there will be some notes. So I will give scanned notes after every lecture so that there is all the material is covered. But let's say that the part that you really should remember forever is basically covered in this book. So the second week, we talk about spin systems. That is an important class of quantum many-body systems, and specifically, we will be concerned with lattice gauge theories. And topologically ordered system. So these are exotic phases of matter, and a lot of recent research is focused on this type of systems. Whereas in the first week, when we talk about quantum phase transitions, we'll also look at spin systems, but of a normal type. The third week, finally, we will talk about quantum many-body physics. Away from equilibrium. So usually when we talk about phases and statistical physics, we usually talk about states that are at equilibrium, which in general, pretty much it means that your state is in the Gibbs state. But since we are interested in this course about quantum many-body physics, so we're talking about quantum states, this pretty much means that we are considering states in situations at a zero temperature, which also, beta is the inverse temperature, so infinite beta. So what is the equilibrium state at infinite temperature? Somebody can answer? Sorry, at infinite inverse temperature. So this means that pretty much at equilibrium, a quantum many body system, is in the ground state. This is just the limit of this state for beta going to infinity. But here in the third week, we will talk about states that are away from equilibrium. So we do not have a state that is in the ground state of the Hamiltonian that describes the system, but it is still in a pure state, but which contains, it's a superposition of, yes, the ground state, but also some excited states. So not being an eigenstate, it will evolve in time, so it will be subject to evolution. And if the system is isolated, then this evolution is unitary, and we will try to understand how thermalization and equilibration happen in this. So how equilibrium is reached, and also what are the universal physics, universal features of the physics away from equilibrium. Okay, so this is more or less the outline of the course. So let's start with quantum phase transitions. Okay, so you have done statistical mechanics, so you know what is in classical physics, what is a phase transition. So who wants to tell me what is a phase transition in classical statistical mechanics? Come on, somebody. Please.
But generally, you have like an order parameter that defines in which phase matter are you. And according to how this order parameter changes, it differs from being in one phase to another. And some macroscopical quantities of each phase are different.
Okay. Yeah. So this is good. So you're saying that we have macroscopic phases that are qualitatively different, and these qualitative behavior is captured by an order parameter, and different order parameters label the different phases. And you also know that, so it's not like the order parameter is always constant in a phase, right? So what really matters usually is what are the symmetry properties of the order parameter. But this doesn't specify clearly what is a phase transition. So of course it should be a transition between the two phases, but what is the definition? So you know that the important quantity is the free energy and then there is the free energy density that is just if we have a system with n bodies, and we consider this system in the thermodynamic limit, so this is called thermodynamic limit. It's just this. Okay, so this is the free energy density. And so we call a phase transition some locus in the phase diagram. So imagine that we have a phase diagram that could be, so our free energy could be a function of, say, the temperature, or some other parameter like the pressure. And you like to, I don't know, draw phase diagrams in this way. So these are the lines of phase transitions, okay? And these are by definition lines where the behavior of the free energy density is non-analytic. Okay? So this is This means that some derivative of the free energy density, so around some of these parameters, let's say the pressure, is discontinuous. So this is a classical phase transition. But what is a quantum phase transition? Yeah, so this is the number of particles. It's the same thing. Yeah. You can do it with the volume or with the number. They're both measures of the size of the system. So what is a quantum phase transition? Well, we want to use the same definition, but at t equals 0. So it's a non-analyticity of the free energy density at t equals 0. Which means that it's a non-analyticity of the energy. So this means that this quantity, let me write some parameter lambda, so E is a function of lambda, is discontinuous. Or, so this should be the energy density, which means the energy per particle that you have in the system. So how can this happen? OK, so the setting is that our system is described by a Hamiltonian that depends on a set of parameters lambda. And it's a smooth function. Of lambda, and lambda is a set of parameters like this. So it has, if you wish, coordinates. Well, then I can diagonalize always this Hamiltonian because it's an Hermitian operator and get the ground state of the system that I will call C0 of lambda. And the energy E0 of lambda, that is the ground state energy. OK. So I don't know if you know this, but this energy, if this Hamiltonian is a continuous function, is a smooth function of lambda, then this is always continuous. Okay, so there cannot be jumps in the energy if the, as a function of lambda, if the Hamiltonian is not. Okay, but it does not need to be analytic. So some derivatives can be discontinuous. So let's consider the case in which the first derivative of the energy is discontinuous. In this case, people talk about a first order phase transition. And so a first order phase transition can happen in many ways, but there is a typical way in which it can happen that is the following. Imagine that I plot my energy levels. So for instance, I plot my ground state energy and my first excited state as a function of lambda. Then you can have a situation like this, a level crossing. Okay. Well, if I have a level crossing, then the the ground state energy X actually is this one, right? It goes like this and then like this. So you can see that in this point, the first derivative is discontinuous. So level crossing. So it is very easy to write a Hamiltonian that has this property. You just take two commuting projectors on two different states, and you interpolate them in this way. So it can happen for a two-level system. So usually, so you know, because it can happen also for a two-level system, this does not seem something that is interesting from the point of view of statistical physics. We would like to understand situations in which things are important for the large system. Moreover, none of the important features of critical behavior are present in this case, exactly because of this reason. So first-order phase transitions are not what we are interested in. So I mention them because they exist. Sometimes they're interesting, but it's not our main concern. Then there are what are called the second order, or to be more precise, is continuous phase, quantum phase transitions. So there was an old classification of phase transitions in terms of what order of the derivative was discontinuous. So one would have a first, second, third, fourth order phase transitions. But now people prefer to talk about continuous phase transitions every time it's something like second order of higher derivative that is discontinuous. And the typical situation is not level crossing, but what is called avoided level crossing. What it means is that our energies do something like this. So they come very close at some value lambda critical. And so here you have a gap, delta E as a function of lambda, that is just E1 minus E0. And for the finite system, this gap is finite. But in the thermodynamic limit, it shrinks to zero. So this means that we have, at this point, we have excitations with as small energy as you want, or in jargon, gapless excitations. Okay? So this is traditionally the mark of a quantum phase transition. Okay, so we start with this thing, that we would like to say that there is a quantum phase transition when the gap shrinks to zero. Okay? So do not take it as a formal definition, but this is typically what happens. So associated to a quantum phase transition, there is this phenomenon. Then we will see something more precise. So associated with the shrinking of the gap, there are some behaviors. So how does the gap behave near the critical point? So there is J that is some energy scale. Then we have a behavior like this. Okay? So it's shrinking as a power law. And we call these critical exponents. I'm sure you have seen something like this for classical phase transitions, in which here you would have t minus tc, and here you would have some other quantity of interest. Okay, but now our quantity of interest is the gap. So as you can see, before the critical point, so deep in one phase and deep in the other phase, there is a gap. Okay, so there is a finite gap. And if we look at two-point correlation functions that are defined in this way, so imagine that we are in a spin system, and I want to measure the correlation of between sigma z at two different points, I and j. Right? Okay, so imagine that we have a spin system, we have many spins, they're labeled by I, J, K, and so on. Okay. We want to measure this object. Actually, this is the expectation value. Okay. So because there is a gap, this quantity will go exponentially down in the distance between the two spins. But there is some characteristic distance that we call psi. So when you have this behavior, you can figure out what is psi. And this is called correlation length. And near the critical point, also correlation length has a very interesting behavior. It diverges. So the critical behavior of psi is to diverge near the critical point in this way. So it also, so you can see by confronting these two expressions that then the gap and psi near the critical point are related in this way. And z alone is called the dynamic critical exponent. So the gap shrinks and correlation length diverges. So this means that we can have correlations that decay not as fast as exponential. They may still decay, but not so fast. They may decay as a power law. The important thing about the critical behavior is that you have a universality. So this means that if you change the details of the Hamiltonian, the critical exponents are robust under slight changes of the Hamilton. Okay. So universality is one very important concept. Okay.
slight is slight? What do you mean by slight changes? I mean, how are we defining what is a slight change and what is it?
So what it means is that there is some finite region in the space of all possible Hamiltonians such that this is true.
Okay.
So this means that the Hamiltonian does not need to be fine-tuned. Maybe this, so it means that you can add a perturbation, and as long as this perturbation does not change something important, like the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, then this would be true. And by perturbation, I mean something that is small enough that you don't change the phase, right? Because if you add some term to the Hamiltonian, you might go to some other phase, or you can cross some phase transition. But if you, yeah, like here, if you deep in the phase, a perturbation means just changing the parameter lambda a little bit.
This universality class then corresponds to an equivalence class of Hamiltonian.
Yes. Okay, equivalent from the point, in this case, from the point of view of the critical behavior. Okay. So we will see an example. I guess Wednesday we'll see an example of universality in the quantumizing model. Ah, okay. So as I said, all this is happening at t equals 0, at the zero temperature. But from the experimental point of view, temperature x at 0 cannot be reached. Okay? We can get very close, though. And it is, in fact, the possibility of getting very close to the ground state, although not exactly at the zero temperature, that made quantum phase transitions interesting. Well, so what happens when you are at very low but non-zero temperature, finite temperature? Yeah?
What other features does the Hamiltonian has to have for this framework to work? I mean, this is not the most general.
Yeah, good question. I'll get back to you. Just let me tell you something about finite temperature, and then I will go exactly there. So let me plot what is the situation for in a diagram that contains our parameter lambda and temperature. Okay? So we have here our quantum critical point. And now we have two types of situations. So we look at the equilibration time, at the local equilibration time. What it means is that we perturb our Hamiltonian a little bit, and then we wait for the observables that are localized in some point of space to reach equilibrium. And we call this time equilibrium time. So when the gap is greater than the inverse temperature, is that right? No, when the gap is greater than the temperature. Then this equilibration time is much larger than this quantity. Okay? That somehow measures the relationship between thermal fluctuations and quantum fluctuations. So in this regime, everything is described very well by classical physics, classical stat-mech. But when the gap is smaller, much smaller than this, then the equilibration time is of this order. And then we have an interplay between quantum effects and thermal effects. So pretty much we have a situation like this. Here in the quantum critical point, everything is purely quantum. Here we are in these regions where the gap is bigger. So nothing quantum is interesting here. Very high up here, well, very high means millikelvins. The temperature is so high that, again, you don't care about quantum effects. But in between here, there is the interplay between quantum and thermal fluctuations. It's called quantum critical. So the important thing is that we will work out a lot of properties at exactly for this point. But then there is a whole region in which they mixed up with the thermal effects. And one needs to be able to weigh the two different contributions, because then in experiments, this is the region that is accessible, not exactly here. So, but we will work in the idealized case in which we are here. These lines, I made them dashed because they are not critical lines. They are called crossovers. So the behavior from quantum critical is smoothly washes out in a classical behavior. You just have that the quantum behavior is less and less important. Okay? But there is a fanning out of the quantum behavior near the critical point at low temperatures. OK, so now to come to your question. Yes. So what are the properties of the Hamiltonian that it has? OK. So the Hamiltonian, so let's look at a bit, some mathematical preliminaries. Okay. So we already said that the Hamiltonian must be a smooth function of these parameters. But this is a quantum many-body system. Okay. So this means that we have also to describe a little bit what is the Hilbert space like, and then talk about locality. So the Hamiltonian must be local. And I will explain exactly what it means. OK, so the Hilbert, quantum system, so usually people who do quantum math, they really love to start their paper by presenting a Hamiltonian. But and usually you just infer what is the Hilbert space from the Hamiltonian. But to be careful, a quantum many-body system is the pair, the Hilbert space and the Hamiltonian. And sometimes this different, the fact that you could write the Hilbert space in different ways can be very crucial. And we'll see how important that is when we talk about quantum gauge theories. So the Hilbert space, we will be concerned with the Hilbert space of in which the degrees of freedom are localized. So this means that we want to write our Hilbert space like the Hilbert space of the first particle, tensor the Hilbert space of the second particle, until the end. Okay? So this means that the particles are localized. So they are distinguishable. Okay? So of course, one can work in the Fock space to deal with bosons and fermions. But in order to take about to talk about quantum phase transitions, we can limit ourselves to this situation in which things are clearer. Okay, so these are called local Hilbert spaces. So now on a local, on a Hilbert space that it has this local structure that is called tensor product structure, we can define local operators. So what is a local operator? So a local operator mathematically must be an operator that acts on the whole space, right? But we want it to be local. This means that somehow, for instance, we want it to operate only on H2. Well, so a local operator on H2 is an operator that has this form. So T has this form. It's the identity on the first spin, or on the first system. Then it's something non-trivial on the second one. And then it's the identity elsewhere. Another way, so jargon, we say that the support of T is H2. Okay? So the support of an operator is those Hilbert spaces in which the operator is not the identity. It's not trivial. So this in particular, we would also say it's a one-body operator. But I could have an operator, a two-body operator, H, that has this form. Okay, so this is a two-body operator, and the support of H is H2 tensor H3. So in order to talk about, if I write here, you guys see, or do you prefer me to switch board?
About this locality, so let's say I don't have O2 tensor O3, but just a non-trivial combination of those, acting just in H2 and H3.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So that was just an example. I could have, so this is not the most general form. I could have O that is operating that on H2 tensor H3. But O itself is not the tensor product, and the support is still like this. Very good. So in general, so these are local operators, so far just in the sense that their support is finite. Okay? But in condensed matter, we also have another stronger form of locality that is about being spatially nearby. So the easiest way, and because it's a discrete system, the easiest way to talk about these things is to put them on a graph. Okay, so what is a graph? So the graph is a pair, V, E. Okay, so V is a set. And the elements of the sets are called vertices or nodes, sometimes something else. And to every node, so to every node in V, we associate a local Hilbert space. Okay? So V is the set of all the local one particle Hilbert space. So set of nodes. And this other one is called the set of edges. And what is it? So E is just a subset of V to the R, meaning the Cartesian product R times. Okay. So for instance, example, R equal 2. So let's take our set of nodes. So V square is the set of all the possible pairs, right? So a subset of all this, the possible pairs is, for instance, this. Or this. Okay. And you see that this constitutes what you have in mind when you think of a graph. So in fact, usually people, when they think of a graph, they always think of R equal 2. Okay? But you can also have graphs with R equal 3 or more. So your edges are subsets of sides 3. And of course, the sides does not need to be homogeneous. You could also mix some edges of sets 2, some edges of sets 4, and so forth, so on and so forth. So given a graph, we are...
Can you repeat that part? It can mix 4 and...
Yeah, yeah. So this is still a subset of elements in V to the 4th. So in this way, we specify, so to each edge, so if L is an edge, then we also specify a Hilbert space that has this form, H of L is equal to the tensor product of HI, where I belongs to L. So the number of particles involved in this Hilbert space is the size of the edge L. So how many nodes are inside L? So there can be 2, there can be 3, 4, and so on and so forth. So finally, given a graph gamma, so this pair, a local, a R local Hamiltonian, is a Hamiltonian that has this form. Where the support of H of L is L. Sorry, HL. And R, here I mean the maximum size of our edges. Okay? So a graph tells you who is near what. These three are nearest neighbors. These three are nearest neighbors, but these are not. So given a graph, there is another important quantity that is the graph distance, which is a natural canonical metric on a graph. So the distance between two nodes A and B. Yeah?
I think, so you're taking H and you're summing over all possible edges, right? So at the end, the support of H is the whole Hilbert space, isn't it?
So that depends on the edges. So I might, in principle, have nodes that are not linked. But this is, you know, just a mathematical possibility. Typically, yes, the support of H is the whole Hilbert space. But H can be written like the sum of local operators. So the locality is encoded in this way, that there are no operators in H that act simultaneously on the whole Hilbert space.
I'm a little bit confused because if I look at the first definition of what we have of a local operator, then if H is acting, let's say, in the case that it's acting on the whole Hilbert space,
yep.
H is still a local operator?
So H is the sum of local operators.
Yeah, it's the sum of local operators, but it doesn't mean that H itself is...
Not according to that definition, but every time I will talk about the locality of H, by H being local, I mean this, that is the sum of local operators. Although, correctly, the support of H is the whole Hilbert space. But it has this structure. So the distance between A and B is just the number. So you can create a path connecting A and B. So a path are intersecting edges such that A and B are contained in the path. Okay? So don't let me write the formal definition. It's clear what is a path from A and B. And then I count the number of edges in the path between A and B. And I minimize over all the possible paths. So this is a uniquely defined distance that can always be defined. OK. So this is another important quantity. So this is the locality of the Hamiltonian. OK, so let's take some examples. So the canonical example is the quantumizing model. Which will be one of the systems that we will study the most during this course. And it is a very beautiful system because it is exactly solvable. And the technology to solve this model is a very important topic in theoretical physics. It's a tool that you will carry with you in the future. And it's based on basically on a technique called the Jordan-Wigner transformation. And you will do it in a tutorial. So the quantumizing model is defined in this way. So we have a graph gamma. And then we have our Hilbert space is the product over all the nodes of the graph of two-level systems. So two-level systems. Or if you wish, spin. One half. Okay. So this is the simplest Hilbert space that we can talk about. So there is no Hilbert space with one level. You must have at least two, something must be able to change, right? So two-level systems, two-dimensional vector space on complex numbers. And we have an array of them. Okay, we have a set of them on a graph gamma. And the Hauer Hamiltonian is this one. So I don't remember. Dennis, you remember? Sachdev puts the G here or here? Let me be consistent with the book.
Here, sigma I x.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure. But it's here, right? Okay. Okay. So what would happen if I kept with my mistake of writing sigma z there?
You can diagonalize it.
What? So yeah, you can diagonalize it even like this, okay? But this is one of the things that we will see. But there is a very important situation that happens. So you see that if I put sigma z, the Hamiltonian is already diagonal in the sigma z basis. And there are no superpositions. So the ground state and all the excited states of the Hamiltonian are just spin configurations. Mm-hmm. Right? So so this means that this is a classical system. So the fact that I've written it with operators doesn't make it more quantum. The point is that there is no difference between writing an operator that has, always the value that it has to have in an eigenstate, and there are no superpositions. The expectation values do not have any variance. But in this way, these are non-commuting operators, so the ground state will be a superposition of different spin configurations. So this makes it, then you have quantum fluctuations. So let's see. So this is a two-local model. Because we have the sum of one body terms. So this, what it really means is that we have sigma x on the spin I, and then the identity everywhere else. So of course, we don't want to carry all this notation with us, and we discharge it. But in principle, it's there. There is the identity everywhere else. And ij is an edge of our system. So we sum over all the edges of our system. And we have two body terms like this. And then there is the identity everywhere else. Also, sometimes people drop the tensor product here. You can drop it, but because it's implicit that it's there. So if our graph is a linear chain, then this is called obviously the 1D Ising model. And so you have, then you can write this as this term just in this way. Right? Because you can label just by one side, one label, the different sides. The 2D Ising model typically is on a square lattice. And again, we have interactions between nearest neighbors, but in two different directions. So also notice that there is a difference between the graph structure of our degrees of freedom. So for instance, in this case, in the IC model, the graph of the interactions and the graph of the spins are the same. And now imagine that they have spins on a square lattice, but then in my Hamiltonian, I have operators that contain four body this way, like in a plaquette. So you see that there are two graphs. One is the graph of the interactions, and one is the graph of the degrees of freedom. And so far, I am always talking about, so in order to define the locality of the Hamiltonian, what is important is the graph of the interactions. One last thing about graph theory is that, so usually, so we know that this is 1D and we know that this is 2D because they are embedded, you know, on R and R squared. So we know that. But imagine that we do not embed the graph and we still, so can we associate a dimension to a graph without embedding it? So it turns out that you can. So what you can do is that you have any graph. You take a distance r, a small r, and the distance is defined in a purely graph theoretic way, like this. Okay. So in this example, this distance r is 1, 2, 3. This is the shortest path. Okay? So you take a distance r, then you make a bubble. So you count all the nodes that are within a distance r. Okay? So you count the number of nodes within r. And it can happen something. So in a generic graph, nothing interesting happens. So there are graphs that are so sparse or so strange that there is no dimension. But sometimes this number scales in this way. Then you call this the dimension. It's called the Hausdorff dimension. And it's actually what you need to do when you have a fractal. And sometimes we have Hamiltonians that are defined on quasi-fractal lattices. So okay. So of course, these are the polymatrices, right? So you're familiar with them. And we typically will work in the basis in which sigma z is diagonal. Okay, so we will call 0 or spin up the eigenvector eigenvalue plus 1 of sigma z and 1 the other one. Whereas we will call plus and minus the eigenvectors of sigma x. So let's look at what happens in this model. Okay. Last 2 minutes. So for G, very, very large, then we can neglect this term. Right? So our Hamiltonian is pretty much just an external field in the x direction everywhere. So what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian? What?
The tensor product of 1 with square root 2 of 0 plus 1.
Yeah. Or, in other words, the tensor product of this guy, of plus. Which, in terms of 0 and 1, is what you said. And because the... So this ground state is unique. So because there is a gap and the ground state is unique, then there is a theorem that we will prove due to Lieb, Mattis, and Schutz that ensures you that the correlation functions decay exponentially at best. They can also be zero. And this is true in the whole phase. So not just for j equals 0, but every time we can do this approximation. So you will do this in a perturbation theory. So in perturbation theory, you can start from this state, perturb it, and then compute the correlation functions with just ordinary perturbation theory. The other phase, so when g goes to 0,
probably we should stop here.
What?
Probably we should stop here.
Okay, yeah. So tomorrow we start from g equals 0. Thank you.